ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to weekdays on ABC Radio National.
Global events, well, they're coming too thick and fast.
We're delivering 5 days a week.
The issues, the challenges are serious, but our aim always is to make it a conversation we can all share. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doog, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Global Roaming.
Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to another edition of The Minefield, where we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens, once more, is my co-host. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Waleed. I'm nervous about this one.
Why? Is it because it wasn't your idea?
Because it wasn't my idea, so I've got no idea what I need to say. No. Look, so, you know, I'm always up early on our recording mornings, partly because I'm a chronic overpreparer. Partly because I just find myself thinking about what it is we're going to discuss overly much. You know, the topics invariably fascinate me, and I want to sort of comport myself well. And as I was, you know, kind of fretting and worrying about this one, I realized, you know, some of the best shows that we've ever done have been the ones where we've not really had a clear roadmap. It's just, it's there to enter in fully to the conversation. And we invariably discover more about ourselves and the topic as the result of not having that fixed idea or the fixed destination than we would have otherwise. You probably don't feel that way. You know exactly how this is going to go.
No, that's how I feel most shows.
Okay.
And I'm with you on that. I would add another thing. My favorite episodes of The Minefield are always the ones that seem to be about something fairly trivial.
True.
And then they unearth things that neither of us probably expected.
Well,
although perhaps you did, given your already mentioned over-preparedness.
Fretting over-preparedness.
Yeah.
It's true. Hey, you are an inveterate traveler. And one of the interesting things at the start of each new year is to get the little reports back from Waleed once he's arrived back from wherever in the world he has been, or little nomic messages from wherever you are with maybe two or three words ... we should discuss.
Yeah, which makes my point in that show where you and Agnes Callard ganged up on me on the question of travel, that there's something inherently valuable about it. Anyway.
Not inherently, but you know.
Yeah, no, inherently.
Circumstantially.
I'm standing by it. No, so this was one of those cases. The specific travel that you're talking about would have been sort of November last year into December. I went and performed what in Arabic is called Umrah. And Umrah is like, you know, the Hajj, the pilgrimage that everyone sort of knows about because you hear about it once a year. It's an enormous thing that happens in Mecca and its surrounding areas, and up to 2 million people might go from all over the world and so on. It's not that, but it's a smaller version of that that is not something that you have to do, but something that a lot of Muslims do, and it involves a trip to Mecca. But it also, very often when you do that, you go and visit Medina as well, which is the, let's call it the second most sacred city in the Islamic tradition. This is not a show about Umrah, but it is a show about something that I noticed when I was there, which is that unlike anywhere else I've really ever been, whenever I do this, I'm observing a collection of people from all over the world. In the case of Hajj, that is, I think, almost literally true. It would be just about every country on the planet that is represented. Maybe not North Korea, I don't know, but like you're talking about the rarest of exceptions. It's not represented in some way. Umrah is a little bit different, but you still get this phenomenon. And so it's this thing of just watching a combination of so many different cultures and traditions all in one place. And the thing that stood out to me on this particular occasion, of all the random things that could have stood out, the thing that stood out to me is, wow, everyone except, let's call them modern Western societies, although it's actually not quite that limited, but let's just go with that for now for illustrative purposes. As a matter of course, wears some kind of head covering. The men, the women, everyone, probably the children actually as well. very often it takes the form of a turban. Sometimes it takes the form of a hat of a of different shapes. My favourite being the ones that the pilgrims from Kyrgyzstan were wearing. Just astonishing hats to me, quite tall and designed in a very particular way. Sometimes they're just what you might call skull caps, but that I don't know if that's the right way to describe it. Mm. But always something. And Omra is a particularly interesting place to observe this because as part of the rites of it, you also cut your hair and you're encouraged to shave it. Mm. And when you're doing it, you're not allowed to wear any headgear. You wear you might have seen this before, the two white sheets that are unstitched. Yes. And everyone's wearing the same thing and you uncover your hair for it. And one of the reasons that that is so striking is, A, you're standing there in something that looks like a burial shroud, effectively. And you're not allowed to cover your hair. That is, you are presenting yourself to the world as though you are disheveled. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of it, if you do the encourage thing and actually shave your head, and I did do that, Scott, and you cannot see the photos. If you do that, you are stripped of kind of all of the finery. Mm-hmm. And the point I'm making there is the finery includes your hair. Mm. One of the things that's always funny is watching the bald guys enjoy so much watching the people who do have hair have it taken off. It's like now it's our day, right? Mm. So you see this sort of, it's very playful, but you see this sort of dynamic. And it just made me think of a couple of things. One is just how deeply in our society where we don't wear head coverings, and we used to not that long ago, but where we don't now, just how deeply hair matters as a marker of vanity and status and so on. And so suddenly to be forcibly deprived of that is something significant. But then also, and I imagine bald men have known this for a long time, but also something about the nature of head coverings themselves, that everyone wearing them in all their various different guises and so on. And I should point out, this is not necessarily inherently religious headdress. This is often just cultural forms of dress, of customary dress.
I did want to ask about that because you're right. There are traditions of either sort of, you know, hats, top hats, bowler hats, pork pies, whatever, yeah, and head coverings more generally within sort of more Western societies. But often they have to do, I mean, certainly head coverings would usually have to do with some form of religious observance. So you would often have sort of women still wearing veils to mass or to church. You would have men wearing hats as a result of, you know, going out into public purposefully.
Yes.
You're saying this isn't that.
Not necessarily. I mean, you can make religious arguments about them, but they're so different and varied and they're so culturally inflected that they're not really wearing a religious garment through and through, even if it does have certain religious information about it, if you know what I mean.
That makes sense.
But also you got this odd thing when compared with the rest of the world of within Christianity, the tradition of taking your hat off when you go to church, that's the more humbling thing to do. But actually, maybe that makes a little bit the point I want to make, which is as you walk around this sea of humanity at a level of diversity, it's very hard to see anywhere else. One of the things I noticed is everyone just somehow looks immediately dignified by it. Hmm. Except for the people who have to take their head coverings off and shave their heads and so on. And they look more disheveled. Okay. But so in other words, it perhaps performs a similar function to what hair does in our society of, you know, here is my status or whatever, perhaps less my vanity. But the difference is because it's cultural and everyone wears it, there are little gradations and so on, but as a general rule, everyone wears some version of it. It's dignifying, but also accessible to everybody.
Mm, interesting.
And the difference is that when you come to the way that hair works in our society, it's very individualistic. I will cut it this way because I want to show this particular thing off, or this frames my face in a way that I like, or I want to stand out, or I'm going to dye it a wild color because that's my individualism. The way that cultural headdresses work seems to me is very much the opposite of that. We will dignify both ourselves and those who we interact with in the public space by meeting a certain standard. The designs, at least the designs that last, tend to be ones that make people look nicer, so they make people look presentable or dignified. But we share them so that we're not, it's not about the individual asserting their status or their vanity or their superiority over someone else. Now, as I say that, there are little riders to that. You know, some forms of turban, for example, you would only wear if you've achieved a particular educational status or whatever, similar to the gown that you get to wear when you graduate or something like that. There are probably very clear class differentiators that are not visible to an outsider like me, but would be visible within. But nonetheless, there is at the very least an entry level of dignity that is collectively conferred by this. And I wondered if there is some connection then between our hatlessness, if you like, on the one hand, and our individualism on the other. Now, I say this, I acknowledge that, you know, there were probably a lot of people not covering their heads in communist societies, and that is probably true as well, and that you couldn't accuse them of being individualist and so on. But that, again, was a kind of more modern utopianism that's at work there. I don't know exactly, Scott, but there is something there that I found utterly fascinating, and even though I'd seen this before, I'd never understood it in quite this way. And that's before you get to specifics of the nature of the headdress, you know, the turban, for example, which takes time to put on, and it requires a certain humbling of oneself to go through that process of the painstaking task and so on, and what that might confer. You could get into all the specifics, but at the level of generality, those were kind of my observations.
I mean, there are already so many threads that I'd want to pull on. I guess one of the immediate temptations, though, Waleed, and I'm going to say this more as a question so that I'm fully understanding the scenario and the ways in which it either does or does not map. You referred to the finery of the hair. And I think on one level, that's right. On another level, hair and skin, and I believe teeth,
very much teeth,
have become the three markers of, now I'm drawing a little bit on shows that we've done in the past. I'm drawing a little bit on work that I've done and things that I've written, but I'm not trying to transpose your topic into an altogether different topic. I'm trying to understand the contours here. But it strikes me that hair and skin and teeth, and maybe we could add to this fragrance or scent, have become the three or four markers whereby we in the West assert two primary things. Number one, the extent to which I am my own creation. So I think it's gone to some extent beyond self-expression to self-cultivation.
Sovereignty over oneself.
Sovereignty over oneself. I am my own creator. So that what I do with my hair, what I do with my skin, which is to say what I have removed or what I have added to it, the way that I want my teeth to appear, and I don't have to tell you that one of the primary markers over the last 3.5 decades of socioeconomic status, particularly in the West, has been teeth health, dental health. The way that one smells, do I smell earthy, animal-like, natural, or do I smell, you know, I'm always stunned by the amount of money that my two teenage boys spend on colognes.
Which is a new thing. No one in my generation, none of the men would do that.
But on all fronts, they each represent, and here I think hair and the lack of hair. So I'm someone who is bald because I was balding, and because I am someone who always reaches for the least possible amount of work and care to put into my appearance. Honest to God, my wife works at a hospital. She wears a uniform every day. There is not a day that I don't look at her with envy. To my mind, to have the decision made for me, something that is entirely unmemorable that I can wear, and just being able to take it all off the top and not having to worry about how my hair looks on any given day, this is liberation for me to worry about other things in life. But I do think, you know, one of the ways that we separate humanity is by those who have control of their hair and those who do not. This also is a longstanding both cultural and racist thing. There are people in some areas of the world that still belong, if you like, in a state of nature. They have a proliferation of hair in the ears, on the top of the head, in the form of beards, out of noses, around their body. Here, it's not hair. It's not depicted as hair as much as it's depicted more like fur. This is the way in which this the lack of self-cultivation has been framed, has been described, has been discussed really for the better part of 175 years, perhaps even longer. I think what's interesting is that in each one of these points, the way that we appear, the way that we present ourselves to the world, this is our escape from a state of, for want of a better term, creatureliness, an escape from a state of nature and our desire to take control of who we are, how we appear, to be our own canvases. There's a French philosopher who I have learned a great deal from who says that one of the great achievements, which is to say one of the great collapses of the modern West, is that the soul has relocated itself to the level of the skin. Whatever our skin is, that's who we truly are, whatever we look like, whatever our appearance is. It seems to me, Willie, that one of the things that you're describing there, even with that offhanded comment about hair as finery, this is one of the ways in which we cultivate, in which we distinguish ourselves over and against others, but also one of the ways that we try to not just distinguish ourselves, but also ascend. We want to achieve a different type of rank. Which is why it strikes me.
Sorry, ascend. You mean socially?
Yes.
Or do you mean ascend in some broader kind of moral sense?
No, not. Well, I mean, it has been moralized. The way that we appear has been moralized. Whether we're overweight or slim and svelte has been moralized.
Yeah, but the reason I ask the question is just about any culture believes in grooming.
Oh, of course.
All of these cultures that I've described with their head coverings and the various associated forms of traditional dress care about grooming. What's interesting to me is it's a collective kind of grooming.
Exactly right.
So the sovereignty element is a bit different.
Yeah. And what you've just described, the raising of the floor of shared dignity and the lowering of the ceiling of free individual expression and variation has the effect of the way that you've described and in contrast to what I've just described about the various ways in which we try to differentiate ourselves, try to render our bodies either objects of envy or by means of the superiority of our bodies, render other persons' bodies as objects of contempt. One of the things that strikes me in the way that you've described it is this raising of the floor and lowering of the ceiling, rendering a certain form of shared dignity, of collective dignification, achievable to all, even if that lowers the ceiling of free individual expression. There is something about that, I think, that is, I mean, part of me wants to say it's a rebuke of the various forms of status seeking and individual differentiation that almost impose themselves upon us as a form of tyranny in cultures like ours. Because it doesn't take that long before the various forms of status differentiation and physical ascent become a kind of expectation. If you have not achieved this level, you are therefore. And then all the derogatory adjectives follow. I mean, that's one thing, I suppose, that does strike me very, very powerfully. I don't know if that maps, though, onto precisely what it is that you wanted to discuss.
I think it's going very well, Scott. If you've just joined us, this is The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali, my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host, and we'll have a guest very, very soon.
Can I ask you about one other thing, though, just before you take it up?
Of course.
So modesty is something that I'm desperately interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Not modesty in the sense of propriety or prudishness, but modesty as a kind of moral philosophical idea. Modesty as the opposite of ostentatiousness, showiness. I mean, if we really wanted to be rude, we might call it attention seeking. I want to be seen. I want to be noticed.
The centering of the self and the rendering of what else there is to the periphery.
Yeah. But I think one of the things about modesty, someone of modest appearance is meant to be, can I say this, unmemorable?
Mm-hmm.
In their appearance, your eyes kind of slide off them. Paradoxically, to be immodest, to be indecent, is to do something that causes you to stand out. Maybe sort of shamefully, but it's to be noticed.
And to seek to be noticed.
And possibly to seek to be noticed.
But I think one of the strange things about modesty, and again, I'm wondering if this maps on what it is that you just described. By seeking a form of habitual modesty, which isn't to say modesty all the time, but modesty as the kind of resting pulse of one's life. Certainly among the moral philosophers that I've learned a great deal from, the premier here being Vladimir Jankélévitch, the great sort of French-Jewish philosopher after the Second World War, he regarded modesty, this commitment to non-ostentatiousness, as one of the ways that we allow our lives and our actions, the various ways in which we try not to draw attention to ourselves, modesty becomes one of the ways that we allow our lives and our actions to allow the attention of the focus of attention to slide off of us and to accrue to others through forms, say, of charity, through forms of benevolence, or of simple everyday kindness. When someone modestly does something just kind for someone else, you don't go away marveling at the kindness that this person has just extended. You look at the person to whom the kindness was extended as someone who was dignified enough to be worthy of that kindness. And so I kind of wonder about the commitment to non-ostentatious, to non-showiness, the way that that has a kind of moral dimension to it, whereby those around, through one's dedication to modesty or decency, those around us are then elevated by our very nondescriptness, if that makes sense.
I want to be careful here.
Yeah.
Because I think what you said is right. But I also don't want to say that all of these modes of dress are unshowy. In some ways, they can be quite showy. It's just that the showiness doesn't as easily, I would say, attach to the individual. And where it does, it's usually through something that has been obtained. So I know I was talking to a particular pilgrim who was from Yemen, who had a magnificent turban. And if you ask him, he will explain to you, well, if you've attained this level of religious study, for example, then you can expose one ear in the way you tie it, and if or an earlobe, or what, you know, all these incredible, subtle little things, right? That's wonderful. I know, for example, I'm Egyptian. I know there are certain hats that are worn within a turban that you can only wear if you're a graduate of Azhar University, for example. Mm. Now, some of that is actually important from the perspective of maintaining the integrity of scholarship, so that, you know, if someone who's wearing that, you know they've studied a certain thing in a certain place, you can rely on what they're saying in a way you may not with someone who hasn't, etc.
It's called academic street cred, Waleed.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. which when you're in a position of, you know, being a guide for people can be really important, right?
Yeah, true.
So now it's not to say these things can never go wrong. Of course they can, and there are examples of people who refuse to wear that because they had a problem with the institution and all this. So I don't want to say that all of this just removes rivalry and removes status and removes differentiations and removes politics and all these sorts of things. It's just that it, does it tame it or does it just express it in a slightly different way? Hmm. There's something about it that strikes me as at least dulling the assertion of the individual's exceptionalism. Hmm. What is interesting to me is that I've heard described traditional forms of dress. The other thing is they tend to be very comfortable, which is another really interesting marker.
Sign
perhaps
me up.
Different from the three-piece suit or whatever, to say nothing of corsets and so on. But if you were to go to these countries, you would see those forms of dress, but you would also then see plenty of people not covering their hair, wearing Western forms of dress, or what you might even just describe as modern forms of dress, but usually that means Western. That's not to say that they necessarily carry around hyper-individualist ideas of the world. Mm. Just as there are a lot of people in Australia who are very collectivist in their outlook rather than individualist, you could perhaps even say Australia tends to lean more that way than, say, the United States. So there's a lot of variety here. But there is, I'm just interested in what ethics seems to be embodied in these sorts of things. And so that's the rider I want to put to your remark about showiness. There are forms of showiness, aren't there? There are forms that are about, I don't know, individual glory. There are forms that are showy in that they're meeting the moment. You might say certain dress codes at certain events operate in that way. And then there are forms that are showy in a kind of class differentiation type way. As human beings, I suppose we're always going to live with some version of them. It's a question of what version we like.
Look, that makes complete sense. Just before we bring in our guest, I guess, well, once again, it is interesting that in the social commerce that we tend to inhabit, fashion is both envy-inducing in the sense of something that is meant to always evade us, to which we are always trying to catch up, and yet part of the trick of being fashionable is never looking like you're trying to catch up too hard. There is a kind of self-defeating tyranny with it. But it is interesting to me, though, what you just said about individual expression, because there are forms of, let's call it mandated individuality, that can in fact be extremely conformist. These are forms of individuality that are, they may not all look the same, but they all reproduce essentially the same logic. And then there are those forms of individual expression that may or may not conform to any kind of fashion dictate or cultural regimen, but that extend from, and you know, you and I both know that there are forms of cultural, political, even in some horrible context, religious conformity that suffocate the soul.
That eliminate the individual.
Yes, yes, that bend and break and restrict the soul. There are forms of individual expression that are celebrations of, for want of a better term, the soul, and that may or may not conform to any social or cultural dictate, but emerge out of one's joyous and expansive interiority. In other words, individual self-expression need not be either hedonistic or egotistical. It can also be a celebration of one's liberation from certain constraints. And there are forms of liberation of the inner life that take external form that really are liberatory. I mean, they really are a shrugging off of forms of kind of mandated social legislation or political religious obedience, and a kind of stepping out into the world joyously. And so it's not so much a desire to be seen as much as it is kind of allowing one's liberated self to take its place in the sun. And anybody who's been involved in communities that cultivate the interior life, that cultivate those forms of, yes, it might look like obedience and self-restriction, but deep down there's a form of joyousness that goes along with it that really far outstrips any kind of cultural dictate.
It's important because people will be screaming freedom as we have this whole discussion. So, I don't know, perhaps we'll expand upon it with our guest. You are listening to The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. As is traditional, we have a guest who will set us straight with far larger pearls of wisdom than anything we've been able to muster. Scott.
Well, so strange is this topic that we actually had to extort our guest to join us on the show.
Freedom here.
Or at least her institution. Lexi Eichelboom is a senior research fellow in the Institute for Religion and Critical Inquiry at the Australian Catholic University. She's a theologian, a critical religion scholar who also works at the intersection of art and culture. Lexi, how could we not have you on the show? Welcome to The Mindfield.
Hi, so nice to be here. Thanks for asking me to join. And I really appreciate the subtlety with which you guys are treating this topic. And I have to first say that I'm really surprised to hear that scent has become one of these avenues for sort of self-creation and communication, because I have no sense of smell. So it's very disturbing to me to learn that there are whole levels of communication happening that I don't know anything about.
You're liberated from them, Lexi, I think. That's what that means.
I am sort of two minds, which it seems like both of you also are around this topic, which I think is probably good. One of my minds is sort of what you were just getting into about some of the distinctions, perhaps, around different ways that self-expression is used and what ostentation is in relation to different people in different contexts, and that it's possibly important to make sure that we're kind of hanging on to some distinctions in the midst of a conversation like this. So, you know, on the one hand, ostentation, if it has to do with signaling a certain kind of social status, whether that's wealth or, as you so, I think, powerfully put it, attempting to render bodies as objects of envy or as objects of contempt. You know, that's one kind of ostentation. That's performing a certain kind of social function. But what about sort of conspicuous nonconformity, right? So thinking especially here of gender nonconformity and how that is communicated through dress in various ways. And as you say, right, this is an attempt to kind of resist some of the social norms by which people can render bodies as objects of envy or contempt. And so ostentation, or, you know, if by that we mean sort of a very loud kind of visible presence, can be used to maybe resist some of those pathways that get used to create those categories and organize those bodies in the first place. So I guess that's sort of like one possibility to, you know, hang on to. But I'm of two minds, because I do also think that there is something in this question of what is this ethic of kind of collective adherence to some kind of common, I don't know, common project, common sameness, being togetherness, a sort of sameness and differentness, right? Because the headdresses are different, but
And there are still options within them. I don't want to give the impression it's a mandated one, like a government-issued sort of garment. Or
yeah. And I think that's a really fascinating question, and that there is possibly something to really take from this idea. So your travels brought to mind my own travels recently. I was in Santiago, Chile for an art and theology workshop and met some colleagues there at the Pontifical University who are studying festivals in rural Chile. These are local festivals that are sort of for the Virgin Mary, but they are also locally inflected in their own ways. And they study art in the context of these festivals. So it's a very different sort of context than ours, in which self-expression, right, is often associated not just with dress, but also with art and what it means to make art. And in this context, art is associated much more with devotion. And this includes dances that the locals will perform, and they all wear the same dress also when they perform these dances. So that's a little bit more of the sameness than you experienced in that context. And the thing that was interesting about that was that there was a bit of a discussion as they were sort of describing this for us about how to name that dress. And they thought, no, let's not call it costume. They're not costumes. Mm. And I took that to mean it's important that we communicate that this was not a performative event.
Wow.
This is some kind of devotional gift. In fact, they describe it as the gift of their fatigue or their tiredness that they are offering up to the Virgin Mary. And so the sameness of the dress there then does seem to be about communicating some kind of communal self-expression, right? It is an expression of something, of devotion, of fatigue even, right? Gratitude. But it's expression not for visibility, not for performance, but expression for the purpose of extending a relationship with someone or something, of kind of reciprocal gift giving. They receive from the Virgin and they give in return. And so, yeah, your story brought this story to mind for me as possibly sort of contributing to this question of, you know, what is this doing or what is the ethic behind this? And does this have something to say to our more sort of individualistic ways of thinking about expression and self-expression?
How would you compare something like that to an example I know Scott has top of mind in this area, which is school uniforms? So, I mean, Scott mentioned his wife's uniform as she goes off to work. We've got a handful of jobs like that, but actually not many. School uniforms might be one of the last frontiers of this kind of collective dressing. And you could even argue, I think there is a fairly strong argument, that it does a similar thing to what I was describing as providing a minimum level of dignity.
Mm.
They tend to be designed in such a way that you wouldn't call them overly formal, but, you know, they're not ripped jeans and a tank top, for example. Everyone's meeting a certain minimum standard and they're meeting at that level. Mm. And yes, kids will always express their individuality by undoing this button or, you know, whatever it is that they want to do. But there is still kind of a meeting point there. Are we talking about something similar or are we talking about something quite different there?
But sorry, Lexi, just before you answer that question, if I can just add a footnote to Waleed's comment, I think the other interesting thing to keep in mind in your answer is, what are kids being freed from by the requirement of wearing a school uniform? So it's not just the imposition of a certain minimal level of dignity. So the kids aren't coming to school sort of looking terrible, you know, not able to bring sufficient clothes. But it's also, what in terms of status seeking are they being liberated from? What are they, and what are they being liberated to? Isn't the liberation to a form of dress meant to enable them to place their energies elsewhere?
Yeah, I do think that's interesting. The liberated to and for, that could be from all kinds of things in terms of sort of comparison and status seeking and all of that. But, you know, if there is some analogy here to something like devotion, then maybe these spaces are about being devoted to something, to persons for whom one is caring, to one's learning and development. I don't know. That seems like a possibility. I am interested in Mary Wollstonecraft's discussion of modesty, because I think her interest is in exactly this, in what it is someone is liberated for by what they don't pay attention to. And so, you know, she's very hard on the women of her day, especially rich women, for their ostentation. And particularly because it means that their concern and their primary attention is directed at what other people think of them. And so they are capitulating to a kind of societal gaze, maybe what we would call the male gaze today. And so her interest is in modesty as a kind of liberating or freeing of women from that concern to be able to think about other things. Now, she doesn't talk about it in terms of dress, but she does have this very interesting and unusual definition where it's a kind of reserve that allows for a commitment to difficult work. And she talks about dignity specifically. So a kind of belief in one's own dignity and self-efficacy that means that one can undertake things that society might be trying to prevent women from undertaking. So importantly, then, she distinguishes it from her understanding of humility that tells women that they are too weak and that they cannot do certain things. Modesty is actually a kind of rigorous belief in one's ability to undertake hard work. But it's modesty because it requires kind of letting go of other sorts of questions and concerns, specifically how one appears in the eyes of others so that one can do the work that one wants to do. So I wonder if that, you know, might be relevant to these sorts of contexts, perhaps.
This is The Mindfield on Radio National. Waleed Ali's my name, Scott Stevens, my co-host. The voice you just heard there belongs to Lexi Eichelboom, who's a Senior Research Fellow in the Institute for Religion and Critical Inquiry at the Australian Catholic University. Lexi, you return to the theme of dignity there, which has gone through, really, this conversation. I think it's worth pausing on it a little, because I just describe my impressionistic response to seeing this array of head coverings, and dignified was just the word that immediately came. I didn't think about it. It was not mediated. It just, that was the word that popped into my head. We do have fashion. We do have some wonderful clothes. I don't know that I would describe the trends in them to be orientated towards dignity. They're orientated towards various things, but dignity almost is never really among them.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's a really good point.
I just wonder what the status of dignity is, not just in our society, but just in our whole moral reckoning.
Yeah, I think you're really onto something there. And I do wonder if there is something in this kind of juxtaposition that you or Scott or both of you together have set up between kind of dignity and this other sort of sense of I am my own creation, right? This other sort of individualistic kind of bootstrapping, which is perhaps a self-expression of another kind. And those, they're sort of like different options, maybe different versions of some sort of impulse, but they lead in very different kinds of directions, because I think there's something about dignity that's not performative, right? And there's something about a will to self-creation, self-establishment that can very easily be co-opted into a kind of competitive, performative marketplace. And that doesn't do really well with dignity, because I think dignity is not a juxtaposition between the individual and the communal. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll put That's it right. that way. The individual is defined in and through its relationship with the communal. How it is that you go about your relationships dignifies both yourself and the people with whom you interact. But if a kind of self is based on performance and on attention and on establishing oneself as the creator of oneself, then that's a kind of competitive logic that gets set up, in which one is atomized and then always competing with others for those kinds of social goods. So maybe that's something of the distinction.
Can I put a slightly different twist on it and hold it up for the two of you to sort of either shoot down or embrace?
Yeah.
One of the formative experiences for me, I'll confess, was being very close to someone who had a particular feature that was obvious in daily interactions that they were very embarrassed about.
So a physical feature.
A physical feature.
Yeah.
And when they would speak, there was always just a little attempt to conceal the mouth or to not look straight on at somebody. In other words, they were always conscious. And then they had very mild but incredibly effective reparatory surgery. And you know what it did? It liberated them from self-consciousness. Mm. And after a while, you know, Waleed, you just said you had that experience of dignity was the word that came to mind. There was a lack of self-consciousness that conveyed an ease in interactions, an unconsciousness and an unembarrassedness of self that conveyed, I think the only term for it, is dignity in everyday social interactions. You know, Lexi, you were just talking before about kind of performative dignity. I don't know, do we want to call this the dignity of waistcoats and top hats? The dignity of sort of endlessly cultivating one's appearance so that one appears dignified.
Well, waistcoats and top hats might be different, though, if everyone's wearing them.
Oh, sure.
Then I think you're talking about something different. But
there is something kind of wonderful, isn't there? I mean, we can talk about universal human dignity with a capital D, and then you live with terrible teeth or a slight facial deformity or a condition of terrible self-consciousness over something that you feel saps your ability to be dignified in everyday interactions, to be non-conspicuous in everyday interactions. And I just wonder how much it's the various ways that we can give people their lack of self-consciousness back, if that isn't one of the more powerful ways of conferring and conveying dignity than all of the international human rights language surrounding the dignity with the capital D. Does that resonate with you at all, Lexi?
Yeah, I love that. I think there's a really lovely kind of artistic image of this, actually, in the sculpture of an artist named Constantin Brancusi,
who was working at the beginning of the 20th century. And he's sort of like Picasso's antithesis. So Picasso was very much
he
about...
He must be wonderful then.
Exactly, right? Yeah. And I think, you know, Picasso was very much about proving that he was his own creation. And he did this through his art and by kind of using and having contempt for the bodies of others and the ways that he kind of used the energy of others to make himself a genius. Brancusi was sort of the opposite of this. In fact, Picasso accused him of being sort of a housewife polishing his pots because he just made all of these very simple forms that all in some ways look very similar to each other. They're not kind of ostentatiously distinguished from each other. They have these very simple shapes. They are all different, though. They are individual. They are unique, but not in a way that they compete with each other. And what's interesting is that many of their surfaces are reflective. So it means that the identity of each one is not only sort of held within the simplicity of its own form, but it also is in it's reflecting what is around it. It reflects whatever other forms are present in the gallery with it. It reflects the people who come to look at it in itself. So when you, you know, talk about giving people a kind of lack of self-consciousness, of making space within oneself, perhaps, for their presence, not kind of being in competition. I think of these sculptures by Brancusi as a kind of image of this.
It's a wonderful metaphor, actually, for a representation of the kind of thing we're talking about. It's just interesting, though, hearing the way Scott put it just then, it brings me back to headdress specifically. Because there is something particular about it, I think. There's something particular about the hair and the variety of hair and the outright denial of hair to certain people and then the overabundance of it. So there's something, it seems to me, in the vehicle for dignification being also the thing that covers up the potential vehicle for differentiation. Do you see what I So in other words, you could confer dignity if you believe everything is just, you know, arbitrary social construction, and I don't believe that, but let's go with that for a second. You could confer dignity in a kind of entirely constructed or just, you know, agreed upon way by the wearing of a particular arm patch or something. But it wouldn't quite be the same thing because it's not covering up the very thing you may use most readily to assert your dominance or assert your increased status. So in a way, it's doing the two things at once, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right there. And I don't know what I would attribute this to exactly, whether it's, you know, some kind of fixed metaphysical thing or just we have phenomenologically, because of the associations we've made with our head being kind of as close to the sky as it is, and then the eons and eons of stories that we have now told ourselves where hair matters. So if you think about fairy tales, right, hair is often an important component in a lot of fairy tales. Think of Rapunzel, right? She is punished by getting her hair cut off. So we do seem to, for whatever reason, confer some kind of symbolic value through the idea of hair. So I don't think it's just random or a coincidence. It is tapping into something probably, you know, really felt across cultures that symbolically this does mean something or feel like something
so,
to us.
So what was going on when we decided to abandon it? And it's not that long ago. One of my favorite ever photos, Scott, just go to sleep for now because you won't care about this, but one of my favorite ever photos of a football match, an Australian rules football match, comes from a semi-final around, let's say, 1910, 1920. And it's phenomenal because it takes in the whole of the MCG, wide lens or something, and you can see the faces of the crowd. It would be more than 100,000 people. And the ones in the foreground, you can individuate them, and everyone is wearing a hat. The schoolboys have a particular kind of cap. The women have a hat that's got a flower on it. and the men have these sort of bowler hat things, every single person. This is not that long ago the grand sweep of history. Somewhere along the line, we, and I don't think it was a committee making a decision, but we just agreed to dispense with all that. What were we doing? What were we trying to do?
Unless you go to the United States where everyone wears baseball caps, which is its own form of...
And baseball caps are interesting to me because I would say they're one of the unique forms of headdress that don't seem to confer
dignity. Be dignified.
The same way. And that's not a criticism of people who wear them. It's just that's not the social operation of them. That's not the way they seem to work.
Yeah, I have no idea. That is a great question.
I don't have any idea either when I ask it, by the way.
I'm not directly sort of answering the question exactly, but just thinking about sort of the ways in which the kind of symbolism of hair works in different kinds of ways. So you pointed out that men historically sort of took off their hats in church.
And you doff your cap.
And you doff your cap.
But you have to have a cap to doff it.
But there were different rules for women.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
And even in Christian scripture, it sort of says explicitly that women need to have their heads covered in church because the glory of the hair is, too much for the angels, whatever that means. There's some change in the symbolism there between men and women for whatever reason. So, this doesn't answer your question about why it's changed. I have no idea. But I'm just sort of noting the different ways in which the significance seems to change, and that now we do seem to be in this period where the significance is located in, what you do with your hair, like whether you dye it and how you cut it and all of these sorts of things. So I don't, how much is that a big difference in symbolic significance, and how much is it just a difference in the way that it gets expressed and mediated socially? I don't know.
Scott, any last thoughts?
Yeah, look, I will just say one of my favorite books is by Rebecca Herzig. It's called Plucked. It's on a cultural history of not just hair, but also hair removal. That's another part of this. This is really, really interesting. Because losing one's hair is shameful.
Right.
Deliberately removing one is something entirely different. I'll also say that I think one element of all of this that we've been kind of tiptoeing around the edges of, certainly in our time, certainly in cultures like these, nobody is neutral about hair, are they? Nobody sort of wakes up, yeah, fair enough, or close enough, or good enough, unless maybe you have a really tight buzz cut and you don't have to, you're either worried that you have...
It's one of the liberating aspects of having shaved my head at that time,
yes.
Scott. It was a very interesting experience.
Yeah. Welcome to my world. But, there's either the, I wish I had more, or I'm so proud of it, I want everyone to see it. The analogy here is Tolkien's ring. It is. It is. Because the curse of the ring is that people have to either lust after, the inhabitants of Middle-earth, either lust after it or they're terrified of it. And you only have that one being, Thomas Bombadil, who is entirely indifferent to it. And it seems to me, whether we're talking about dignity or whether we're talking about deeper forms of individuality, individual self-expression, or if we're talking about the kind of non-self-consciousness that is a form itself of liberation in the world, maybe one of the things that we're urging ourselves towards here is finding some way of becoming indifferent to the status symbol of hair so that we no longer want more of it nor are terrified by the loss of it.
I suspect we replace it with a different status symbol. But that's not to say all status symbols are equal. This is maybe, if we're a species that needs status symbols, there are better versions of that and worse versions as well. Maybe that's another show. Lexi's off to research why it is exactly that we got rid of headwear and what it means. There you go. You're always
looking
for another research
report
project.
Back.
That's right.
Someone will fund it. Thank you very much for coming in, Lexi.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
That's really good fun. Lexi Eichelboom, Senior Research Fellow in the Institute for Religion and Critical Inquiry at the Australian Catholic University, our guest for this week's edition of The Mindfield. Scott was trepidatious. Wasn't that bad, was it? Catch us again next week on ABC Radio National or anytime on ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.